CliffCentral.com.
African Analysis has been with us all year, and we are going to be, I'm very happy to say, starting a brand new season of African Analysis next year with JJ Cornish and, of course, the Johannesburg Business School, who, if you haven't seen what they do, you need to go and check them out. Go and look at what the Johannesburg Business School is up to. Go and look at what they do with their MBA graduates. It's absolutely phenomenal. They're also extremely interested in what's happening in the rest of Africa. Why? Because they're a smart business school who realize that Africa is one of the places where they have not yet, where markets have not been entirely exploited, where there are huge numbers of consumers, where there is massive opportunity. And the Joburg Business School is at the forefront of discovering these new markets, making sense of them. That's one of the reasons that they bring us African Analysis every 2 weeks. JJ Cornish, of course, is the most informed guy we could find on the continent when it comes to looking at all the important current affairs from all over: elections, the economies of various countries, the state of play in the continent, Francophone and Anglophone Africa, and so many other things. So we get to spend time with him every 2 weeks. And today is our last episode of the year. So we welcome, as always, Jean-Jacques Cornish. How are you, sir?
Bonjour to you, Gareth. If maybe next year you can fit me in next to some other kind of insert, because your last one, the only way I have of expressing anything about that is, ain't got no class.
Oh, wow. That's the best, because, yeah, I'm sorry that we even had to talk about that before bringing you on. Unbelievable, right? So let's talk, JJ, about basically about the year in review, because there's quite a lot that's happened in current affairs in Africa in the last couple of months. There's always news. There's news breaking here, there, and everywhere. We've got elections to talk about, as I mentioned just a moment ago. But you've got some things that you want to talk to us about on the last day of African Analysis. So where do we begin?
Well, you know, I thought, because I know you like lists.
I love lists.
And because your viewers and listeners love lists, and yes. I've got Africa's 10 richest countries. Now, that's something.
Excellent.
We start the richest country, and by a little way, is Nigeria. Now, I often argue with that because they have grown-up problems. But it's Nigeria, number one, with a GDP of $477 billion, gross domestic product.
Wow.
South Africa comes in second with $409 billion. Egypt is third with 405. And then it starts falling off. We have Algeria, 228 billion. Morocco, 142 billion. Well, in fact, Angola's ahead of Morocco with 163 billion. And then Morocco. And then Ethiopia, 111.3. Then Kenya. Then Ghana. And then Tanzania. Now, why do I doubt Nigeria is that, you know, Nigeria has inflation currently at 25.8%. It has sluggish growth, millions in poverty there, inadequate infrastructure. They've got tariff and trade and non-tariff barriers on trade. And the infrastructure is a lack of it in the country. You know, we talk about every time we put up a mall, a Nigerian says to me, we don't even have anything like that in Nigeria. You have, you know, two or three per city, or more than that per city. There's a lack of confidence in the currency in Nigeria, and a limitation on foreign exchange. So they have these problems. But interestingly, at COP28, the biggest con job on the planet, COP it always is, you know, they have this meeting. And then what do? My goodness, they go over the deadline. They've done it 28 times. They go over the deadline. And then after a day and a half of stopping the clock, as they like to call it, they suddenly come up with a, quotes, breakthrough. Well, after the COP in Durban, I said I will never cover another one because it's a con job of the people. But worst of all, it's a con job of the media, and they make me want to tell you there's been a breakthrough when there hasn't been, and there wasn't at this last one either. So you know, it's very, very, very sad. But there were these countries talking, well, you know, there was a nuance on fossil fuels. But when we have countries like Nigeria, we have countries like Algeria, we have countries like Ghana in that all have fossil fuels in the country. Nigeria put it quite well, saying, if you want to have this fall down in the fossil fuels before we've been able to enrich ourselves properly, it's like putting us on life support, but not allowing us to breathe. You know? But yes. I mean, anyway, so there was this dichotomy. They all everybody said we had to, you can't use the phrase phase out. So you had to transition away from, and it was really an exercise in gymnastics of word gymnastics, and it was really wordplay. Really awful. Absolute.
Yeah. But JJ, I'm so glad that you're saying this stuff, because I, for one, am sick to death of seeing these endless summits where world leaders pitch up. They sit and they talk to each other. They stay in 5-star hotels. The taxpayers of those countries are forced to cough up, and then we are told how bad we are for driving cars, for running businesses, for using electricity, by a bunch of leaders who realize at some level they must realize that they're self-conscious frauds, right? So they're aware of the fact that they're lying, that the only way your country develops, the only way that things get better for people in that country, the only way you raise people out of poverty is by having abundant energy, by creating opportunities for business, by allowing people to trade as freely as possible. And yet these guys get together to do exactly the opposite. And then they thumb their noses at us from there.
Well, you know, I've got one interesting element from this COP 28. And they started with this damage fund and said, we will pay those countries affected by climate change. Well, Africa, for example, you know that in terms of carbon emissions, Africa is responsible for 4% of the world's carbon emissions. And if you take us, the freedom-loving People's Republic of South Africa, out of that, then the contribution by the rest of the continent is virtually negligible. But they've decided that they've got to pay. They started on day one agreeing to pay this amount. Do you know that COP 15 in Copenhagen, so work it out, that's 15 years ago, they decided to pay compensation to small countries and developing countries affected by climate change. We have yet to have that paid. We have yet to have them honor that promise from 15 years ago. So COP is such a con job. It should be called Con 17 and Con 18 and Con 19. It really is shameful.
Crooked.
The way that, you know, crooked. Really they're frightful. Crooked.
There's no other way to put it. Okay, so JJ, when these people get together, you've been to some of these summits. You said you've reported on them and you refuse to do it now. Just tell us what kinds of things these leaders get up to. Because most of us will never attend a Davos or a COP 28 or a G20 summit or any of these various meetings that these people are flown to and are put up at, and then sit around and basically are mocking everyone else on earth. Well, what do they do? What do these guys do? They have dinners? What do they do? Well,
they have dinners. They have talk shops. You know, they talk and talk and talk. Now, I am an inveterate multilateralist. I believe that multilateral politics is the only thing short of war in the so I for example support the United Nations, and I get irritated by people saying, well, what are the United Nations doing about it? The United Nations is a vast organization, and you can't say what are they doing about it when you don't know which bodies are in play. But it has shown itself to be, unfortunately, completely toothless of late. Look what they are doing on Ukraine. Nothing, because of the veto. Look at, so we say we need to end the invasion of on the war against Ukraine, and everybody says yes, and they all agree. Now the point is, it's non-binding if the General Assembly says or does something. It's non-binding. As it happens, Gareth, what we were talking about, COP, is non-binding too. You know, everybody says, so are they going to implement what they decided at COP? Everybody laughs. Those in the know laugh and say, no, this is the United Nations. They'll try and put moral pressure on and so on. But there's nothing. The only binding things that the United Nations does are by the Security Council under Chapter 7. And that was, for example, sanctions that they can apply, but nothing else. And of course, if they don't, if it's not in the Security Council, then it has no muscle, whatever. Look at Israel when the world's saying we've got to have a ceasefire. We've got 20,000 innocent Palestinians killed now in Gaza. There has to be a ceasefire. Then the United States says, "Well, no." Nope. You can't have a ceasefire because that will play into Hamas's hands. So they support their friend in that area, Israel, and so nothing can be done. Of course, the Britain, even worse, in their craven way, just abstain. They don't even cast the veto. I, when I was at the United Nations, had three countries, Britain, France, and the United States, the three Western permanent members of the Security Council, repeatedly casting vetoes supporting apartheid South Africa. But that was the time of the Cold War. They were fighting effectively against Russia, you see, and so if Russia wanted something, they had to oppose that. So it was a silly game. The only time the triple veto from the Western powers fell was after the death of Steve Biko and the banning of the world newspaper, and apartheid regime just went too far, and they brought in sanctions, but not the sanctions that were called for. They brought in an arms embargo, a mandatory arms embargo, and because they said we can't have South Africa being that dangerous.
Well, you talk
so,
about
so it
the
worked
UN.
Then.
You talk about the UN and the Security Council and the veto powers of the major powers, but at least those are major powers. You know, when Russia or China or America or the UK, for whatever reason, they're still on that list of major powers. I don't think they are anymore. But anyway, those are the countries that founded the UN, that were the members of the Security Council from the beginning. At least those countries carry some weight. You know, there are military consequences to their decisions. There are economic consequences to their decisions. What I think is so ridiculous about the UN is that the president of Burkina Faso gets up there and starts lecturing the world about what's wrong. And nobody's interested in what Burkina Faso have to say. How does South Africa line up? How do we square up at the UN? Because for a while, wasn't Phumzile Mlambo Ngcuka, she was the head of the UN's, what was it? Human Rights Commission or Department of Women and whatever it was.
Dealing with women's rights. You know, what you're talking about there is what Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the U.S. ambassador at the time I was there, used to call the tyranny of the majority. But you've got to remember that whatever Burkina Faso or the smaller nations have to say is at the General Assembly, and even when they get the vote at the General Assembly, it doesn't matter because it just has moral weight, but nothing more than that. So,
I mean, wasn't like Iran were in charge of like their women's rights for a little while. I mean, Iran, really?
Well, when you have the Human Rights Commission, then they had all sorts of people coming on, and they do it by blocks. You know, the Africans decide who will represent Africa on these bodies. Now, South Africa has done well in the new South Africa, democratic South Africa, three times on the Security Council. But what we learned there is that you can make some friends, but you can certainly make some very serious enemies too. And so it's a fraught business. But when they want to enlarge the Security Council, then clearly countries that have real muscle, like Japan and Germany, should come on. Mm. And when that happens, the Italians kept on an ambassador way past retirement because he was very, very, very good at this. And I'm sorry, his name has just escaped me. I was smuggled into the delegates' lounge at one of the summits in South Africa to go and interview him. And as I was interviewing him, he was looking at the woman passing more than talking to me. But anyway, the point he made very astutely was, if you are going to increase the Security Council by including the losers of the Second World War, i.e. Japan and Germany, then you've got to include us too, Italy. So,
but it's
never happened. You know, they wanted South Africa to be on, and of course, who would be on if we came on? South Africa, of course, wouldn't say, yes, we want to, wouldn't throw its hat in the ring, we want to. They would say, well, we need two from Africa. And then suddenly countries like China and Russia, who were prepared to take on one Africa, just lost their appetite for this. So, I mean, you know, we're talking about the UN Security Council instead of the richest African nations, but perhaps at the end of the year, that's not a bad thing. But it's a body that if it didn't exist, well, you know, I think I would fear the worst for the world. But sometimes the way it behaves, you wonder what it is really worth, and whether it's worth the money that countries pay. In fact, not all the countries do pay. That's the point.
Yeah, you know, that's another thing. That's
don't worth pay their subs. Yeah, but you know, here you have the multilateral system is severely, severely under threat at the moment. In our own, in Africa, we have the peacekeepers in the Congo. Well, they have the elections this week in the Congo. They are moving out. The force, the political force in Sudan has moved out because the United Nations cannot be where the authorities in that country don't want them to be, and that the military regime in Sudan says, we don't want you here. So the United Nations says, okay, we're not abandoning you, Sudan, but we're getting out. And, you know, this is something I'm looking at very much with Lilian Schlapper, who I'm writing the book, sort of talking about South African foreign policy, sort of pegged to his quite amazing career. And he's not well at the moment, but that's the one area that we've still got to go through is the damage and the threat to the multilateral system, which I think is the greatest threat to world order and to the future of this world. Perhaps not as great as is climate change, but certainly it's nipping at its heels.
All right. Well, we'll agree to leave that one alone for the rest of 2023, JJ. But let's go to your list. I think this is quite an exciting thing to talk about. So you've already mentioned which countries have the biggest economies.
Yes.
South Africa used to be at the top of that list. We've been superseded by Nigeria, and I know Egypt is nipping on our heels as well.
Yes.
Why have we lost prominence? Why have we lost market share, so to speak, on the continent? It used to be that South Africa was the gateway to the rest of Africa. We represented an opportunity for multinational corporations, international business, other governments to make their way into Africa and to access this incredible market. Have we lost political clout? Is that part of the problem? Have we slowed our economy because of things like energy abundance? Have we slowed our economy to the point where we're not taken seriously by major players in the market? What is it that we've miscalculated and done wrong so that we should end up no longer being the most important market in Africa?
Well, you know, bear in mind that South Africa once sold electrical power all the way up to Ethiopia. We were the power that the country that lit up. You know, we lit the streets of a city with electrical power before any other countries in the world. And this is the Eskom and the corporations like that. Well, of course, that's gone. We can't even keep the power on in our own country at the moment. The moral weight that a democratic South Africa had has diminished completely. We're unable to speak to Africa with the authority that we once had or that we briefly had in the Mandela period and to a large extent in the Mbeki period. And so we've lost that. And we go along. We're still considered within Africa as being something. And this area of the gateway, it was much abused. But yes, you want to get into sub-Saharan Africa, then you probably have to come through South Africa still. But it's parlous the way the South Africans, the situation has fallen off. Nigeria, of course, the oil has done the job there. And it's going to be, according to the list I have, it will be the top country for some time to come, despite the problems it is having. Egypt, of course, nipping at South Africa's heels. Absolutely. I mean, I was once used to ask, is Egypt really an African country? Because, you know, it's Middle Eastern as well. It could be part of that. But it is there. And they've just had this election with Abdel Fattah el-Sisi winning the election. The announcement was overnight with something like 90% of the vote. Well, when you get figures like that, you worry about the democracy.
That always sounds very suspicious, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, beaten only by what, Kim Il-sung and people like that. But, you know, we've got 102% of the vote. But, no, it's very sad. But they had quite a big turnout, 66%. But they have record inflation, depreciating currency, forex crippling, forex crunch on foreign exchange, and you know, they're 67 registered million registered voters, had very little choice. Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's number one opponent left the field some months ago, complaining that he'd been intimidated and so on. So there were sort of three in line, but he won it. So that's, you know, when you were speaking about your election 101. And that's what I was saying. It's all very well to say, yes, we've had elections every 5 years, but what has led up to those, and what is the result? You know, you can fool with elections, and that's certainly what he's been doing. He threw out Mohamed Morsi. I was election observer for Mohamed Morsi's election, and whatever problems you might have had with him, he was fairly elected, and now Abdel Fattah el-Sisi's had this. Change, constitutional change after a referendum. So he's got his terms have been increased to 6 years from 4 years, but he's only allowed two of them. But the first one, and many African leaders have done that, doesn't actually count. You know, that doesn't count as one of the terms. So he's going to be in power till 2020. We have then, when we get to other countries like Algeria, in every case, they have real inflation. Real inflationary pressure and commodity price increases because of the Russian invasion or the Russian war against the Ukraine.
Well, I'm going to have to draw this to a close. I'm sad to say, because I know there's so much more that we could talk about, but we do have a whole year of African analysis ahead of us in the new year. And JJ, I hope you will have a very happy Christmas and New Year, and we will see you in 2024.
Well, let me say to everyone, Joyeux Noël et bonne année, you know, happy Christmas, joyous Christmas, and a happy new year.
Thank you, JJ, and all the best to you. We'll see you in 2024.
Looking forward to it.
Omelette du fromage, JJ.
Cheers. Bye-bye. CliffCentral.com.